Good morning, fellow creatures. It's really wonderful to be back on retreat with you all and to have all this time just to be sitting silently, stilly, expressing ourselves on the cushion. And it kind of seems like a paradox that we can be silent and not moving and be expressing ourselves. But actually, I think that's the essence of what we're doing here. I think we tend to think about self-expression in a narrow way. So it's, what do I have to say based on my experience? And yesterday, Myoko gave us a beautiful example of a broader sense, because the pot is actually expressing itself at the same time as Myoko is expressing herself, making the pot. And with Zazen, it's the same thing. It's not just what do I have to say based on my experience, but what do all things have to say based on the experience of all things? All things can express themselves in Zazen through our body and mind. And it's really not a mystical thing, it's a very logical thing. If we are shaped by our relationships with all things, then naturally all things are expressing themselves through us. So we are being expressed as much as we are expressing. It's not just my Zazen and my practice. It's also the Zazen of the checkerboard floor or the Zazen of the machines that are heating this room or the Zazen of the cough that just happened or the Zazen of the person sitting next to you. And this is going on full-time, non-stop. It's going on when we're sitting, standing, walking, lying down, when we're chanting, when we're bowing, when we're sewing or working in the kitchen, when we're eating, when we're going to the bathroom. Dogen talked about continuous practice, but I think what we're doing on this retreat is could be called continuous expression. Continuous expression of the truth of your life, including the truth of your discomfort or your judgments or your resistance, all of it. I want to second Myoko's greetings to all of you who are new to Village Zendo or who haven't done this kind of retreat before. I know that, as Arshuso said, many of you will be leaving today. So I also want to say farewell to those of you who are leaving. You've had the chance to really settle down into a very still, quiet place while you've been here. And when you leave here, you'll have the chance to take your true expression with you. Back into your lives, back into your worlds. So I hope you have a good reentry, and just remind you that that reentry process is a little easier if you keep up your meditation practice, your breathing practice, your waking up practice. This morning, I wanted to take the opportunity to share with you an example of what I think of as true expression. It's kind of an unusual example, but I bring it up in part because I think it's very contemporary. It's a story from 300 years ago, but it still feels to me very close today. It's the story of a man named Benjamin Lay. And this comes from a new biography that's been written by a radical historian at the University of Pittsburgh named Marcus Rediker. And I recommend the book. There's a lot more to it than what I can transmit this morning. About a man who is virtually unknown, at least in our times. And the few historians who have run across him in the archives pretty much dismissed him as a crank or a crazy guy. There were a lot of other things that I wanted to talk about this morning, including Dogen's study text, which we were assigned to talk about, Dotoku expressions. But I am going to be carried away a little bit by the story of Benjamin Lay, and I'm not going to resist that. So hopefully there'll be some other opportunities to talk about other things, other issues, including Dotoku. So, and also apologies in advance. This isn't going to be a very Zen talk. Benjamin Lay was born in 1682 in a modest Quaker family in a village in Essex County in England. And he was born as a little person. He stood just a little over 4 feet tall. He had a hunched back, and one person described him as having a projecting chest. He had limited schooling. As a young man, his first work involved being a shepherd on a farm. And Essex was a big textile region, and he naturally learned a lot of the aspects of the trade, manufacturing. He was a very skilled spinner. He subsequently worked as a glover. Glovers were one of the what were called the stinking trades, because they had to work with the skins of dead animals to make the leather, to make the gloves. He didn't like it much, but he did a fair amount of it. He subsequently became a common sailor, and he sailed around the world, got to see a lot of the world, and that would shape him profoundly. And later he wrote that he, quote, truly and sincerely desires the present and eternal welfare and happiness of all mankind, all the world over, of all colors and nations, as his own soul. After his sailing days came to an end, he married Sarah Smith. She was also a little person and a hunchback. And like Benjamin Lay, she had grown up in a Quaker family. In fact, she was considered quite a gifted preacher and received a lot of respect, became a designated Quaker minister. She was loved in a lot of the Quaker communities where she lived. The couple traveled together to London to set themselves up, but in short time, Benjamin developed a reputation as a troublemaker in the Quaker world. He was very free in his criticism of others in the community, and what was most scandalous is that he dared to criticize the ministers, and he would speak up in the Quaker meetings. You know, the Quaker meetings are not that different from what we do here. People sit around in silence, but the difference is that at a certain point, if they feel moved by the Spirit, they'll stand up and they'll say what comes to them to say. But Benjamin would often, after someone had, one of the ministers had done something like this, Benjamin would then stand up and say that they were preaching their own words and not God's truth. He would say that they were too full of themselves, too pleased with their performances. And he said they were too restless and uneasy in sitting in silence. So he called on them to be silent and sit down. Would have made a good monitor for us. So he was censured by the entire London Quaker community, which investigated the matter for his unruliness. A lot of historians, as I said, have thought that Benjamin Lay was just a crank, but Marcus Rediker shows that actually he was coming out of a long tradition of radical dissent in English history. There were a whole series of religious groups, political groups, that had, in a sense, cultivated tradition which he was a part of. So these would be like groups like the Levelers. You may have heard of some of them, the Diggers, the Seekers, the Ranters. And the early Quakers themselves were actually quite revolutionary. Many of them protested the social hierarchy in England, and they questioned any kind of assumed authority on the part of church or state. Many of them believed that no class, no social class, and no institution had the right to regulate the free conscience or to subject the free spirit of the individual. So this was a radical tradition that really became very strong at the time of the English Revolution in the 17th century. By the time when Benjamin Lay was coming of age in the late 17th, early 18th century, the authorities had pretty much managed to put out the flames of this dissent, but Benjamin Lay had read about them and been inspired by these earlier generations of radical Quakers and antinomians. And the tradition would survive beyond Benjamin Lay. In the late 18th century, it would come up again and find expression in the genius of the poet and illustrator William Blake, who's been invoked in many a Dharma talk. Another source of inspiration for Benjamin was his reading about classical times, and particularly the figure of Diogenes and the group of Cynics. And the Cynics had a few principles that they followed. One was free and candid speech, including towards worldly authorities, self-sufficiency or self-reliance, rigorous training to develop physical resilience, patient self-restraint to develop moral character, and an attack on wealth, prestige, and appearance. And Rediker suggests that Benjamin's fierce character may have also had something to do with his so-called disability and with the disrespect that he had experienced as a little person. His experience may have contributed to the empathy that he would come to express throughout his life for enslaved people, the poor, animals, the natural world. So his physical condition may have been a source of both his compassion and his combativeness. Benjamin came under a great deal of hostility in London. His membership within the Quaker community was questioned, and so Benjamin and Sarah decided to go abroad, and they set out in 1718 for the island of Barbados in the Caribbean. This was made sense because Barbados was the first had the first Quaker community anywhere in the New World. It was also in the early 18th century a thriving English colony and one of the most prosperous and profitable slave societies anywhere in the world. So Benjamin and Sarah set up a shop on the docks in the port capital of Bridgetown, and they immediately began to witness the intense exploitation of the labor of the enslaved African men, women, children that were sustaining the sugar economy. And they witnessed the extreme violence that was used to keep the system going. This was appalling to them, and it was something that would mark them for the rest of their life. When they began to fraternize with enslaved people, began to hear their stories about the mistreatment they were subject to, they began to speak out against slavery. And this instantly provoked outrage on the part of the planter class, who were at the point of expelling them from the island when they decided that they too had had enough after 18 months. So they went back to England in 1720, and immediately the conflicts with the Quaker authorities resumed, and the questions about whether or not Benjamin was a part of the Quaker community, the whole legal process about that. But they held out for about 12 years and finally decided it was time to flee again. And this time they went to North America and they set up in Philadelphia. But no sooner was Benjamin Philadelphia than he began to denounce the evils of slavery that he saw around him. And once again, he was pitted in battle against the most powerful Quaquer authorities, these people with very high standing political rank as well as economic power. So he would go to Quaker meetings, and if any slave owner stood up to preach, Benjamin Lay would then stand up to denounce him for hypocrisy. "There's another Negro master," he would say. So the authorities in the church couldn't abide this, and they would have him seized in the middle of the meeting, and picked up and carried out of the room, and he wouldn't resist. But the next week, he would come back. And he did this at meeting houses throughout Pennsylvania, to the point that the authorities had to set up guards outside of all the meeting houses to prevent him from coming in. So he became quite a notorious personality. On another occasion, he was invited over for breakfast to the home of a respectable gentleman. And when he saw a black man walk into the room to serve the meal, he asked his host, "Dost thou keep Negro slaves in thy family?" And when the man said he did, Benjamin stood up and declared, "Then I will not partake with thee of the fruits of thy unrighteousness." Benjamin wrote one book, which was entitled, the title captures the spirit of it, "All Slave Keepers That Keep the Innocent in Bondage, Apostates." Historians see this as the fourth book in the English-speaking world that would call for an end to slavery. There were a few others earlier in the 18th century. It's interesting that the book was printed in 1738 by Benjamin Franklin, but Franklin did not have the courage to put his name on the book as the printer. Benjamin Franklin actually was very ambivalent about slavery, and he was uncomfortable with it, but he didn't have the courage to speak out against it until much later. And Lay was also a performance artist, like our Shuso. Marcus Rediker said that he engaged in guerrilla theater. So on one occasion in 1742, he went into the downtown. And at this point, his wife, Sarah, had died. She died in 1735. But she had acquired somehow some fine china. So Benjamin set up a table in a public space, and he put out all of the china on the table. And the crowd began to gather around, like, what's this guy up to? And then he took a hammer, picked it up, and went around, blah, blam, breaking one teacup and saucer after another. And the crowd was completely riled up. "Stop, don't, what are you doing? It's like, if you don't want it, give it to me." And finally, some big young guys grabbed him and carried him off, and he didn't resist. And the crowd grabbed up the remaining china and took it off home to them. But this was Benjamin's way of protesting against the forced labor that was used to produce the tea in Asia and to protest against the forced labor that was used to produce the sugar in people's tea in the Americas. After Sarah died, Benjamin set himself up in a cave in the countryside, and he tried to live outside the expanding networks of the global capitalist economy. He lined the cave with rock. He kept a library there. He didn't have much schooling, but he was an autodidact, and reading was very important to him. He had about 200 titles. When people visited him, they found that the cave was full of skeins of thread that he had spun himself. He kept a spinning jenny in there, too. He refused to consume any commodities that were made with bonded labor. He made his own clothing that he wore. He refused to wear wool that had been shorn from sheep or to eat any animal products except for honey. He had a big apiary. And he considered animals just other fellow creatures, God's creatures. He refused to ride horses because he saw it as a form of domination. So wherever he went, he would go on his own 2 feet, which were often barefoot because he wasn't going to wear leather as an animal product. He practiced fasting. He grew his own food, including melons, Yoko, on the patch of land around the cave. When visitors would come, he liked to serve them root vegetables and tell them how good they were for them. My partner and I get a farm share, and every winter we get piles of root vegetables, and every time it's like, oh no, what do I do with more root vegetables? But Benjamin Lay has given me a new appreciation for these humble crops. And his aspiration was, in his words, that the earth might become a paradise again to all people, as it is to some. Marcus Rediker's book is called The Fearless Benjamin Lay, the Quaker dwarf who became the first revolutionary abolitionist. And he says the first revolutionary abolitionist because although there were a few exceptional voices prior to Benjamin who denounced slavery as wrong, he was the first to advocate immediate emancipation. In other words, it's not just that the offspring of the enslaved in a generation could be free, or that there should be some period of time to tutor the slaves in order to become citizens. He believed in immediate emancipation. And in the 1730s and 1740s, Benjamin was really swimming against the current. He was fighting an uphill battle all the time. It would be an exaggeration to say he was a one-man social movement, but that's not so far from the truth. There were not many other people, many other comrades initially. So he played a really important role in bringing attention to this moral problem, raising the issue for debate, for questioning, and gradually there did develop in this period a grassroots movement for abolition within the Quaker world. His health began to decline in the mid-1750s, and in 1758 he received a visit from someone who informed him that the Quaker authorities, after all the pressure that had been brought to bear, had decided to discipline or to expel from the community any Quakers who were involved in the slave trade. And this is how Marcus Rediker describes the encounter, and he's drawing on the testimony of the witness to this. When the friend relayed this news, Benjamin fell silent. After a few moments' reflection, he rose from his chair and, in an attitude of devotional reverence, stated, "Thanksgiving and praise be rendered unto the Lord God." A few minutes later, he added, "I can now die in peace." Benjamin believed fervently in the equality of all creatures before God and in the sinfulness of covetousness. That's what slavery was to him, a form of covetousness. And he was opposed to any kind of class oppression, racial oppression, oppression of animals, oppression of nature. Those were his convictions, and he actually lived by them. It's the remarkable thing. Redeker writes, he expressed the truth as praxis through his little body. So, what makes this so contemporary? Maybe it's obvious. There are so many pressing issues in our own time. I was thinking as I was reading about Benjamin Lay that we need a few more Benjamin Lays among us today. But I also realized that actually there are a lot of people out there expressing themselves in similar ways, in a similar spirit. You can see it in all the social movements, occasionally in individual voices. I recently read that in Benjamin's Pennsylvania, there is an order of Catholic sisters called the Adorers of the Blood of Christ who have allied with local activists, many of them religious people and older people in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, who are opposing the building of a pipeline for fracked oil that would go through their property. 23 people were arrested for a civil disobedience at the pipeline site this fall. And I thought of the water warriors at Standing Rock who've been resisting the Dakota Access Pipeline, or closer at hand in New Jersey, the anti-pipeline resistance by the Ramapo at Split Rock, Black Lives Matter, and the protests against police violence against black men and women and youth. All of these expressions of resistance may, in a sense, be in the spirit of Benjamin Lay. I don't mean to say that I think we should all become righteous scourges and prophets. Can you imagine how unsufferable that would be? And actually, I think there are not very many of us who have the strength of conviction and the courage and the consistency and constancy of Benjamin Lay. And there really are infinite ways in which we can express the truth. But I also think there is a little Benjamin Lay in all of us. So maybe the story of Benjamin can help us look at our own conduct and our own expression. In this time of ongo, when we intensify our practice, maybe we can scrutinize our lives a little bit and see if there are some ways in which we might demonstrate greater courage and consistency and constancy in acting on our convictions. And there are opportunities, infinite opportunities around us. One is the Village Zendo Action Group is going to be launched in January. And it will be concentrating, among other things, on issues of criminal justice and criminal injustice. If you live in or around the Newark area, you can talk to Cynthia Gyoko about all the great environmental justice work that they're doing across the river. Infinite opportunities, really. Even in the little things, a conversation we may be having about the affairs of the day, or how we deal with the social hierarchy that we're enmeshed in, or what we consume. Yesterday at breakfast, I got up to the table And there was one line that went over to the oatmeal. I thought of Quaker oats. And the other line went to the scrambled eggs. And my eyes lit up. Ah, protein, that's what I need. And I went up and I served myself some eggs. And then I thought of Benjamin Lay, and he would have been saying, "That's not protein. Those are your fellow creatures." So the next day I went to the oatmeal line and added a little peanut butter. And it's not, I'm not sure I actually want to give up eggs, but Benjamin Lay has got me questioning things. So as Shuso said at the beginning of the retreat, we're here practicing intensively and turning the light within. And Roshi said, when we turn the light within, it can help us to act outwardly and express ourselves in ways that are more skillful and more compassionate towards our fellow creatures, to use the language of the old English radicals. And skill and compassion towards the world that sustains us. So I'll end just with one last anecdote about Benjamin. One day, a ship captain out of Philadelphia named John McPherson saw Benjamin Lay, and he decided he was traveling with a party of friends, and he decided he'd have he'd put on a little entertainment for his party. So he went up to Benjamin and using I'm gonna draw from Marcus Rediker here. He was using the deferential, gentlemanly language of the time, and he declared himself, presented himself to Benjamin, declared himself to be his most humble servant. And a crowd gathered around, and Benjamin asked in response, "Art thou my servant?" And McPherson answered, "Yes, I am." So Benjamin raised his foot toward the captain and demanded, "Then clean my shoe." And the crowd burst out in laughter because insincere speech had gotten what it deserved, which was mockery. So seeking to redeem himself, Captain McPherson asked if Benjamin could please instruct him as to the direct route to heaven. And Benjamin asked, "Dost thou indeed wish to be taught?" And McPherson insisted that he did. And Benjamin then replied in a more serious way, quoting the prophet Micah, "Do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with thy God."